Good morning, agus fáilteas teach. This broadcast of WNYE's Irish Radio Hour, This Irish American Life, comes to you in association with Flannelly Promotions Limited. I'm Dr. Miriam Nighan-Gray, and I am your host every Saturday morning on WNYE 91.5 FM in the Tri-State area, and broadcasting worldwide on www.irishradio.com. Our theme music is The Opening Set by The Gloaming, released by Brassland and Real World Records. Since 2014, I have been hosting this radio hour and am honoured to have the opportunity to bring to you interviews, talks and performances which speak to the Irish and Irish-American experience. As a historian trained in Ireland, Italy and the US, I have used interviews as a major component of my research, and I am always thrilled and honoured to use the medium of radio to share aspects of educational and ethnic interest. WNYE 91.5 FM is managed and operated by NYC Media, a part of the Mayor's Office of Media and Entertainment. Broadcasting throughout the metropolitan area from the 4 Times Square Tower in Midtown Manhattan, it serves the public 24/7 with its schedule of programming. The programming aims to inform, educate, and reflect the diversity of interests that make up New York City's population. I hope you'll enjoy this week's This Irish American Life. On this week's This Irish American Life, I'm thrilled to be sharing an interview with someone I've had the good fortune of getting to know over the last few years. His name is Jude Hughes, and Jude's life story reflects many aspects of Irish history over the 20th century and indeed into the 21st century. And on this week's show, Jude is sitting down with me to share some of his life history. It's a fascinating story. Jude was born in the early 1940s. He's of mixed race background. And he was put into, like many children of that era, in those circumstances, Jude was put into the industrial school system, I suppose is the best way of describing it. So over the course of this interview, I'll be chatting to Jude about that and about his life as a professional tailor and about the things that he has done in his life, in a sense, to make the world and make Ireland a better place. So it's an immense privilege to share with you part one of this interview, and I'll conclude the other part of the interview on this week's This Irish American Life, folks. So for the rest of the show, you'll be hearing me in conversation with the wonderful, inspiring, humbling man, Mr. Jude Hughes. Enjoy. Today is Monday, the 14th of November, 2022. And I'm here at 71 Middle Abbey Street in Dublin 1 with Mr. Jude Hughes. Jude is conducting this interview out of his free will, and I'm really honoured to be here with him this evening to undertake maybe what will be just the first part of an oral history with you, Jude. First of all, thank you so much. This is a very big honour for me personally and professionally. And I want to thank you for allowing me to do this with you today. I'll start off, Jude, by asking you to start at the beginning for you. When and where you were born, and about your childhood or what you've been able to reconstruct a little bit about your family history.
Yes, well, I was born the 11th of the 5th, 41.
11th of May, 41.
Yeah, in St. Patrick's Institute, Navan Road.
Okay.
I was there for 4 years, then I graduated then to St. Philomena's, Stillaughlin, which was the next section of the institution. then I graduated from St. Philomena's to Carrigley Park, which is now Dunleary Arts Place out in Baker's Corner. From there I moved then down to Tralee, County Kerry. So that was my whole life practically in institutions up to 16.
So you were saying you were 4 years in St. Pat's on the Navan Road.
Yes.
And then you went to
St. Philomena's, Stillorgan.
Okay, and how long were you there?
And I was there till I was about 8.
Okay, so another 4 years, right?
Then I moved from there to Carrigley, which was near Baker's Corner, which is now the Dunleary Arts
Centre.
Place out in Dunleary.
And how long were you there
And I was there till 1954.
Okay.
Then 54, the place closed and I was shifted down to St. Joseph's, Tralee, County Kerry.
And then you were there till you were 16?
Yes.
If it's not too hard, Jude, I'm, conscious that people's experience in those institutions sometimes wasn't great. What are you able to tell us about your time in those places?
Well, you did know, as a young person, you did know you were different because of the colour of your skin and because you had curly hair. And it had advantages as a kid because people loved. And remember, the time I was born, there were a handful of people like me, very few. So it was a novelty. So you kept getting petted on the head, given sweets for no reason and all that type of stuff. And you began to have a dream that, geez, it's great to be black. They all love black people, you know.
You were kind of like a novelty.
Yeah, because remember, we're talking about the 40s and the 50s. The only black people that were here back in those days were only sons of chiefs studying medicine or law at Trinity. And there were only a handful of them at that time.
Do you remember a moment when you realised you were different to most of the other kids around you?
Oh, you were aware you were different because, obviously, with the colour. But you had that innocent thing that you had. You felt you had the slight advantage because you were always being given sweets and patted on the head and all that stuff was going on. So you developed a wrong conception of being black at that age. I'm talking about as a
young child.
Young child.
And were there any other kids who looked like you in any of those four places?
No.
Oh, wow.
I was the only person at that time.
Do you remember, Jude, and this might be skipping forward, do you remember when you saw a person of colour like you for the first time?
Yes. I remember an odd time if I went out, I might see a person on the street, but it'd be they usually were a student, but very few.
Very few.
The first time I actually shook hands with another black person was, believe it or not, down in Tralee. I was in a band. I remember day I was at the Listowel races, and by coincidence, they were celebrating some big festival in Listowel and they brought over a guy called Prince Monolulu. Now, Prince Monolulu was not a prince, but he gave himself that name. But he was a tipster for horses. But he was a black lad from New York.
Oh, wow.
And his famous quote was, "I've got an horse." Now, that was the in-joke at the butt. They brought him out because he was famous for going to the derbies and all these others, and also down to Kentucky, So they brought him over. He was a bit of a racehorse tipster, but a bit of a, as far as you could see, a chancer. But he dressed in big full, colourful plumes of the big robe. So naturally, when he was at that, everybody could see, there's a black fella, there's a black person. And I remember they got him to come over and sat down, shook hands and chatted. And then he gave me photographs of famous boxers that he did photographs with, like Joe Louse, Sugar Ray, Edwards, you know, there was another, Charles Edwards, something. But there were famous boxers back in those days.
Yeah. So when would that have been, in the 60s?
No, that was in the 50s. Now, they were retired, some of them, but the problem was, when I got those, they were taken off me. I never got them back.
And what age were you when you were in this band, Jude?
I was around 12, 13, 14. You know, I was in the band in Tralee.
And what kind of band was it?
It was like an arcane band, you know.
Okay.
Just like band. We attended the races and all that type of stuff. All the different festivals in Kerry.
And what instrument did you play?
I played the baritone euphonium.
Oh.
In the band, you know.
And do you have good memories of being in the band?
I think, well, the school was tough, like anybody, but being in the band and playing basketball did help to break the monotony of the school. The monotony, it meant I had an added extra luxury. In fact, because I played sports and then I was in the band. So, by attending all these different events and all the big carnivals and anything else, if there was a boat being or a church being opened, the band was there. If there was a big festival in any village or town, the band was there. So that helped to knock the dreariness of the school.
And were those schools?
But it was as tough as any other place. I mean, you knew, you learned to be streetwise. Because, you know, some of these brothers, as you, everyone knows, weren't fit to be. Even, they just were utter bullies. Now, that's some of them. And you learned how to handle them. And I do remember one time I wouldn't eat a dinner, and they made me kneel at the back of the refectory, and they said, stay there till you eat that dinner. And I knew after about 10 feet that this guy would leave me here for the next hour or more. So I got up, picked up the dinner, and threw it at him, and walked out and started playing basketball out in the yard. Everybody said, right, Jude, you're in for it when you come in for the evening. Because dinner at that time was around 1 o'clock in those days. So lunchtime, evening lunch was around 5, 5:30. And everybody was expecting a showdown because he was in charge of the refectory. I walked in, sat down where I came, and nothing happened.
He didn't do anything.
And I think he knew that was the last time he was going to bully me.
Wow.
And I would have thrown anything at him if he tried anything. And he knew it.
And were they all hard, Jude? All of the teachers? And
no, not them all. No, there was only 3 or 4 of these who, they should never have been even allowed. They were just utter bullies. You realise, of course, in hindsight, you realise a lot of these became brothers because they were done it to please their mothers or something, but they certainly weren't dedicated teachers. They were utter bullies, tyrants, I reckon.
All the children in those institutions, Jude, were in a similar situation to you, presumably. Their moms had been either forced or felt they had to give.
Some were sent there by courts or sent by peculiar, you can never understand. Okay, some of them, one or two of the parents died or something, and then they ended up. Others were there under court orders for probably a bit of stealing, you know. But where I find the problem was, some places like these where you were treated as everyone in there was a criminal. And that's where I felt they got it all wrong, you know. Or whether they had this attitude, oh, you're in the school and we'll make you toe the line, you know. And they were too restrictive. But you learned, you know, to be streetwise. I know I did.
So, say as a young child, or even up until the time when you finished in Tralee, what did you know about your parents, Jude, and who you were? Jude Hughes from?
This was the problem. I could never get the proper information. And at the beginning, I was led, oh, yeah, someone told me your thing is from the... They said, met my mother, said I was from the mother was from the Caribbean. And I was kind of believing this. And Trinidad was mentioned, but then I'd no proof of that. So I kept believing I was from there. Now, when you leave the school, you make an effort to get your birth certificate. But back then, what was on your birth certificate was very little. And this is where problems started. You just got only the mother's name, no information, only a thing called County Carlo. You couldn't go on that. And of course, there was efforts made to get more details and more, and I was getting nowhere. And other people tried and they were getting nowhere. And I kind of left it at that. Because at that time, you just accepted that, you know.
So you gave up?
Yes. Technically, I didn't try. Because there was other efforts made to get a bit more than that. But you just couldn't get it. Now, at that time, you didn't know that there was deliberate laws and redacted laws that were in these institutions where they stopped you from getting information, and that was part of the game. That's what was said. Now, at the time, you didn't know these, but it's only in hindsight when you found out later, you found out you couldn't get this under Act This, or this is redacted, or that's redacted. And of course, yeah, I'm talking, I only got found out all this only in the last 10 years. Whereas 40 years, 50 years ago, I'd have loved to challenge that back then, but nobody could do anything, because that was it. You couldn't challenge it before. Now, I noticed my first chance of really challenging it was, unfortunately, during the recent Judge Murphy mother and baby thing. After my event with her, I asked her a very simple question. Why is there people stopped from getting information of their background after 16 under Act This or redacted? Why is that in their documents? And they said, oh, she said to me, oh, back in the 80s, someone challenged that and the High Court upheld it. And of course, that meant you couldn't do any more. Now, only this time I said, excuse me, everybody in Europe and in England can get their information once they're 16. How come we're not getting it here? And then she said, well, the High Court. Now, I realised everything was the High Court, and if your High Court upheld it, you can't challenge it. Then I said to her, is it in the Constitution? And they looked at one another and said, no. And then I said, then if it's not in the Constitution, we're in Europe since 1973. And the only things that are protected are in the Constitution. And if this is not any, European law overrides this. And I got a yes from her. And that's the first time we had proof that this was illegal. And they've been getting away with that. And here am I talking to her in 2016-17. Which is crazy. Now, I said to her, as a result of this, people spent the last 40, 50 years looking for this information, and it was deliberately left. So, therefore, the whole thing was illegal under human rights, under Geneva rights, and under personal freedom of information. And this was all denied, and everybody after they left their institutions were put through an extra 40, 50 years of misery. And some of them eventually found their mothers 3 months ago, 5 months ago, 6 months ago, when they could have found this information 40, 50 years ago. And they found their mother might have only died only a year ago. Now, I could never understand why that was allowed to go on. And every time you challenged it with the government, the Attorney General would say, oh, on legal advice, and an excuse not to give the information out. Now, that was a denial of persons' human rights. And I think the government is paying for this for the next 60 years. The misery they add, in other words, besides being an institution, they added another 40, 50 years of misery to all these people who were in the institutions, and there was no need of that. And that was denial of their rights.
In that vein, Jude,
yeah.
What have you been able to reconstruct then since about your parents?
Once we got that, in the meantime, we set out. Now, because I wasn't getting much information, I started going through DNA. And as a result of that, I was able to find out where my DNA was, and it led to Nigeria. That's one half. The other half was Carlo. And we eventually got the town in Carlo, and we were able to link up Milltown in Carlo with my mother's name, and link up, and that. So I was able to then trace through Dr. Morris Gleason, the DNA expert, and slowly we began to put a jigsaw puzzle together. And to our surprise, I was able to find connections with the Hughes family and to the Nigerian family, Major Godomi family's DNA matching. So that helped start the ball rolling. I've since had photographs of both my mother and some of the African ancestors as a result of that.
So you might not want to go into specifics, Jude, or maybe you do, whatever you share with us, whatever you're comfortable with. But either specifically or generally, can you tell us about how you came to be in terms of your mother and father? Have you been able to reconstruct that? Where do you think they met, or you know?
Yes, I was able to trace them. The mother, first of all, the family in Milltown, Hughes family. I was able to trace their father, the grandfather, and the mother. And when I got that, I also got a link to aunts, uncles, and everything. I then was able to figure out where they had emigrated from Milltown to Bunclody. And Bunclody is where some of the family are buried, and I was able to go down to the graves of their family and see for myself the grandfather, the grandmother, two uncles and an aunt buried in one big grave there. So that was the first time. Now, then, someone contacted me from London, explained to me that he was my half-brother. And that was a power family. And he then, I asked him, we first of all checked out the details so that mine matched what I knew. Mm-hmm. And same grandfather, the same family links, so everything matched. And I asked him, would you have any photographs of the mother? And he says, I do. She married in 1947, I was born in 1941, so this. Now, he sent me the photographs, and that's the first time I'd had a photograph of my mother.
Wow.
So, that was, at least, I now had a blood match, brother, half-brother, and that sorted the Irish side link.
when was this, Jude, like, so how long?
Unfortunately, only 4 or 5 years ago.
So you were in your mid-70s when you saw your mother for the first time?
First time I did a photograph.
So is your understanding then that she married in England in 1947?
She married, Mr. Joseph Patrick Power. And I have a photograph of that family.
Tell us then about the Nigerian side and how...
Same thing, that was DNA. And then, very simple, I asked a friend of mine, would you ever check out, was there ever anybody by the name of a magical dummy in Trinity pre-1941? I haven't a clue. You only hear a name like that. And to my surprise, he came back. He says, there were two people of magical dummies there studying since 1936-37. And that was it. Now, the other thing was, one of them had a match of 107 DNA.
107%?
Yeah. DNA match. So that gave us a start.
So you that think least, then your father was a student in Trinity?
Yes, definitely. In fact, I've since got proof of all that, and also there's other distant cousins who've since been in contact, and they have matched to that as well.
So then do you think
so
your parents...
photographs with some cousins as well at the moment.
So do you think your mum lived here in Dublin?
She was at the sewing trade. She worked for Singers.
Where would that have been, Jude?
Singers in Mary Street. It was then a big place back then.
Wow.
And she was written down as a machinist.
So I'm talking to you in your tailor premises. So you must have only found this out about her in recent years too. Well, or did you know that?
I knew that with the Sisters of Charity, they gave me some information saying she worked as a machinist and that she lived in Belgrave Square in Rathmines. Now, we're talking about in the 40s. You know.
During the emergency. Right? 1941?
No.
The war
was on. I'm talking about 45 to 40, maybe from the 40s. I just don't know the exact time she worked in Singers, but in that during that time she was registered as a machinist.
Wow, isn't that amazing? So then, from what you can gather, your dad was here over studying. Was he from Lagos or where?
He was in the medicine.
And where in Nigeria range. Was he from? Do you know?
It's in the Lagos area, right? From the Yoruba tribe.
And have you been able to find out, like, when he died and stuff like that?
Yes, so we have the whole records.
Well. But when you were in these institutions, Jude, just to be clear, was your name always Jude Hughes?
Yes.
So you knew. You knew there was Hughes.
Well, it was the mother's name.
Yeah.
That's the way they always did it.
Yeah, yeah.
But a lot of times they deliberately left out the father's names.
Yeah.
Sometimes it was done deliberately. Now, I am aware that sometimes it was done to hide the fact, you know, as you know, there's incidents where the family are to blame for that. She could have been ostracized. All this goes into it, because there's very little about her until I found there was a link up with her sister at her wedding in Bunclody, when one of the sisters, her sister married a Professor O'Meelan in Galway University. So then there's a mention of her as one of the bridesmaids.
I assume your half-brother didn't know, like, when he was young that you existed or anything, did he?
He only found out in the last 4 or 5 years. He said, when he rang me up, He says he knew about me about a year or two before he rang me. And I think he wasn't quite sure.
How did he find out?
Family, there was someone checking, looking for relatives of the Hughes family. My Mary Hughes came up and my name came up.
And he started doing a bit of digging.
It matched. I was saying I was the son of Mary Hughes, but such and such and such, everything matched, and he found he was the son of Mary Hughes. Something's wrong here. In fact, they found out more by accident.
And so Jude, what
And then he looked, he found articles about me. That's how he was able to phone me.
Wow. Did he phone you here?
Yes. In fact, in this workplace, about over two years ago. Wow. That was the first I knew.
Did you nearly die?
I thought it was a joke at the beginning. And then, when we, as I told you, when we checked out, everything matched what I had. Because I'd already got this information, and he was able to name everybody I had. And he had realized we both had the same people.
How was that as a feeling?
Well, I was kind of shocked and elated at the same time. But at least he had, for the first time, he says, I'm your half-brother, and clarified it, you know.
That's the first time in your life you've had a blood relative on that side?
Yes, which was nice. And it also brought an end to, at least now I know my background. Really, my problem was, you go through life without an identity. To me, is unforgivable to these authorities who deliberately set out to that. And they don't seem to understand the harm they do to people by letting them swim around searching, knowing that they have this information, and they just deliberately play this game. And to me, that's an added piece of cruelty they do on these people. And it doesn't make any sense why they do it. And it's only since... This is the issue I had with Judge Murphy. And it's only then they agreed to let everybody have their full information. I mean, they didn't need anybody to tell them that. That was their basic human rights. Now, if you can imagine all the people of every, you know, whether they were white or black, denied this and went through life almost without a proper identity. That was scandalous. You know, and it doesn't seem to have registered with these people.
When you come out of all this schooling, I like the way you use graduated. It's a nice term. And
I'd say more newfound freedom.
Okay, well, when you found him at the age of 16, what were your choices?
I was then beginning to be aware of the situation with, let's say, black people. I was beginning to take notice of the problems in South Africa and America with the civil rights. And I began, let's say, even before I left the school, around maybe 14, 15, I began to start seeing things in the papers and what the hell was going on. And I couldn't understand how people had laws against black people sitting on a seat or getting up on a bus, let a white person sit down, or some areas a white person couldn't go into a restaurant. And I began to say, God, not everybody likes black people, you know, in my innocence. Up to then, you know, with the nice type of easy life I was having, it's not as simple as I thought it was. And then I began to be aware, maybe all this petting on the head and all this is a load of, you know, false misunderstanding I had about the way people love black people. And then I began to read more and more, read some books, and I was getting shocked and shocked at how could they dehumanize people like this and still talk about the Bible and God and everything. You know, the same people who are, I once like was puzzled at, the deep south in America, they could throw the Bible at you and read it verbatim to you, and yet they saw nothing wrong with dehumanizing black people. To me, I couldn't understand how could they correlate the two of them. Mm-hmm. It was a contradiction. If they believed in human rights or believed in God and everyone is the one God and all that, and yet, no, it's our God, not your God. So I could see the clashes were going to come anyway, sooner or later, with that carry on. And the so-called educated people saw nothing wrong with doing this, you know, season after year, and the hell black people went through over all this, just for basic decency, and think they had the divine right to trample on the rights of other because of the colour of their skin. And so I begin to get more and more outraged about this.
How then, from a career point of view, or what, you know, you're out in the world at the age of 16, Jude.
Yes.
And you've had 16 odd years in these various institutions.
Yeah.
What kinds of choices had you in terms of what you would do with yourself,
well,
career-wise?
I started learning the tailoring trade in the school. The job was to get me started at tailoring. I believe they had trouble getting me started at tailoring.
Because didn't want to do it?
No, because I really wanted to employ a black person. So I think I stayed a few more months longer after 16 because of that. But eventually they got me working with a tailor up here in Dublin. I think they were keen that I go to Dublin because I could have got lost if it was any in the middle of nowhere. Then I stayed in what they call hostels at the early stage. In fact, next door here was the Catholic boys' home. I started there. Some believe.
On Middle Abbey Street?
Yeah. Across the road in Lower Abbey Street is where I started the tailoring. Now, as you know, when you leave institutions, you're on your own. Now, this is something people need to realise, that when you leave after 16, there isn't the kind of welfare system that helps people back then. And you know, now you learn very fast, you either sink or swim. And I was reasonable enough to tell you to know I had to survive. Now, just leaving after being stuck in an institution, and then at the beginning, it's like a newfound freedom, because you're able to go to the pictures, you're able to stay out, and you enjoy that for a while. But then gradually, there's more to life than that. I used to play sports, basketball, and I was in a band. Now, luckily, someone gave me the address of somebody before I left Tralee to contact someone up here, and I did, and I ended up joining basketball club as a result of that.
What was the name of the basketball club?
It was originally St. Dublin Celtic Basketball Club. Then I moved from there to St. Joseph's Basketball Club in Clontarf. The likes of Kevin Heffernan and them were on that team, back then, ex-Dublin footballers. Then another funny thing was, I was one time in Bachelor's Walk and this band came along. It stopped where I was standing and were playing this tune, and I recognised it, and I was kind of banging on top of my feet and whistling away. And when they stopped, this bass player came directly over to me and says to me, "Tell me the name of that tune." I told him who wrote it, and he says, "Only a person that can play would know that." He says, "We practice here on a Thursday and a Sunday. You're welcome to join us."
And did
so that's how I ended up in the band. Now, to me, it was very important to be able to occupy yourself in the evenings. Because an awful lot of people who are used to institutionalized with groups of people, suddenly you're on your own. So this helped to distract me and keep me occupied. I ended up joining an Olga as well. So I ended up... An Olga was the youth hostel.
Yeah, well, you joined that.
Where you had to be in before time for that. So I ended up wicklowing all these mad places. So that helped me a little bit. Now, the other thing that helped me was I got introduced to a family. And I remember, in fact, the tailor, I don't know, a nun introduced her brother to me, the Smith family. And I was in the hostel here, and about a week before Christmas, he came in. He said, Sister Francis told me about you. We'd love to invite you up for Christmas, because he knew I was on my own in this place. So, for the next 20-something more Christmases, I ended up with the Smith family.
And who was that family?
They were lovely.
Dublin family?
Yeah. So, that did help, because otherwise I'd have been bored to death. And you know, you're used to groups of people, and suddenly you're on your own, and twiddling your fingers on Christmas Day, you know. And I think all these helped. They were all stepping stones to help me.
In this time still?
I was still, you know, 16 and a half, 8, you know.
Yeah, you were young enough. Yeah.
This is now a mad start after leaving. Within about 2 months or 3 months, I was in a band, and I was in a bass party, and I got to know a family.
And would you have been too young, or would Dublin then, would they have had things like dance halls and things like that? Was that something you were into, Jude?
Well, I didn't mix up too well, because I was aware, see, I was too aware that now, it's very hard to get, let's say, honestly, Caucasian girls take an interest in you, and after all, what I was only starting out, I wouldn't be able to even entertain a girl back then. You know, you've got to remember, we left institutions very innocent compared to today. I mean, today, 14-year-olds would show you a few things we wouldn't have known, you know. And then lads would go, well, some of the lads made friends and we'd go to dance together, but, you know, it was the old-fashioned way, you know. I don't know if you remember those days. The fellas on one side and the girls on the other side, and you could ask them, they could refuse, they could ask you. There's one to another time there was ladies' choice, they could ask you, but, you know, most of the time you were left on your own, so you couldn't realize you couldn't be bothered wasting your time at this. But the odd time you'd get a surprise, and a girl would come over and ask you, and you could see the look on the other fella's face. You could see it, bored, the eyes boring. So I used to think a white girl had to be very strong to ask a black person up to dance in front of it. Well, I probably was the only black person there. I was aware of that type of situation. Then, of course, with the, looking at the historical side of it, you knew people resented Irish girls going out with black people. So, unfortunately, I was aware of all that. So I wasn't too pushy about it, because to me it was important that if I was going to be with a person, there wouldn't be none of that. Otherwise there'd be only problems down the road. So that did hold me back a bit. Probably I was too aware of the problems, partly because you read the stories, you listened to stuff, and then you had the civil rights and you saw the laws where they didn't allow white girls to mix with black people. I mean, you saw some of those films, even the last few films, I remember, even it hammered at home the mentality of people, you know. And then I used to remember the odd time I'd go over the girl, I'd be walking down the street, and you could feel the look she'd get, especially from the older ladies. In fact, I remember one time I used to have a bit of fun. I used to say to this girl, now see these two nice little dear old dears looking at you, and say, look at them. Now, watch, when we pass, they'll turn around and look back. And then I'd say to the girl, you know what they're saying? And she'd say, no, what's a little fella like me doing with you? But that was like an in-joke. But you knew. If eyes could tell, you knew.
In that period of time, say, in the late 1950s and stuff, now I know you were young.
Mm.
But in that period of time, there were a lot of young Irish people going to England and to places like London and Manchester and Birmingham. Oh, yeah. Did you ever consider doing that?
Yes. In fact, I have a brilliant story to match that. Like everything, I was keen. I felt a bit lost here because there was hardly any black people.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I began to meet more black people in Dublin, no doubt about that. But there still wasn't that many. And there was this lovely understanding. We'd pass one another and we'd just nod. It was like, and then one time one of them stopped me and said, "Hello, brother." And that was the way they greeted you. And I thought that was nice.
Mm-hmm.
And that was my first dealing. Because remember, I was never used to meeting black people.
Yeah. Because you'd been always the only black person, right?
And I was used to living with white people.
Mm-hmm.
And suddenly, and then now one or two would stop and say, "Hello, brother," you know? Because
mm-hmm.
they thought I was another student, you know? Mm-hmm. And so it helped a bit. And they'd ask. And so that's how I got slowly. But then I got into the anti-apartheid movement. Because remember, I was still being the anti-apartheid beginning in the 60s, and there were a lot of things happening in the 60s. To me, I felt, was the new awakening. The young generation was saying, "We're not taking any more of this." The young black generation, even the young students in the Sorbonne, the rising Algeria, all the African countries were demanding their freedoms in the 60s. So there was a complete new movement, and the young generations were behind them. This was what was new. And the young black people were saying, "We're not going to accept what our fathers had to accept." So the civil rights got stronger. The African countries got demanded more and more. And if you notice, in the 60s, 90% of the African countries got their freedom. There was a serious move in the civil rights. This anti-apartheid got stronger and stronger from then on. And I was in with that. So it was a lovely time because it made the old generation sit up and say, "What ye laws ye had in these places, we couldn't accept them anymore. It's wrong. How can you talk about God and human rights and do this to and degrade another section just because of the colour of their skin?" And of course, to a certain extent, thank the young students of the Sorbonne and all the universities in America began to make a stand, because they realised you can't walk two types of lines and pretend there's no change, you know. It's not acceptable anymore. And anti-Vietnam, and you can see where the likes of Muhammad Ali stood up to the American system and say, "I can fight for my country, I can run for my country, but I'm still a second-class citizen. And you tell me to fight against people I didn't do any harm with." How great that was. A brilliant statement he made. And for the first time, he woke up a lot of the black generation, because none of them questioned it before, but it made a lot of them stand up. And that's why I give him the likes of credit for waking up the black people, because a lot of them hadn't spotted that.
Bring me back then to you going to England or not going to England.
Yes. I thought it'd be nice. Remember, a lot of the Afro-Caribbean people were now in England, but there was hardly any here, and I might fit in better with them. So Dublin Bus used to advert, not Dublin Bus, London Transport used to advertise in the papers here. And it was a write in, and you get called for an interview up at the Gresham Hotel. I went up and gave you a few stupid papers with adding, subtracting, multiplications. And of course, in about 2 minutes, I was standing up. You know, his wife go in to this room, and the lad said, "Oh, yeah, you speak good English, yeah? Oh, yeah, do you need to do? I go into the next room. The next room was a lady. And the lady said, ah, Mr. Hughes, I see you're the tailoring. Yeah. And then she looked at the suit and said, did you make that suit? I said, yes, I did. Very proud, you know. Yes, I did, you know. You know the way you dress up for an interview? And she says, you don't really want this job. And I said, what makes you think that? She said, anyone that makes a suit like that, there's no way it's going to be end up as a conductor or something, you know. She says, I tell you what you're doing. You're using this as a platform till you see what you can fit into in around Savarow. She was dead right. That's exactly what I was planning. I wanted a safety valve before I could go around, because I believe they were looking for anyone who's good at, reasonably good at tailoring, you know, handcraft tailoring, and they'd get jobs. That's what I was looking for. And I wanted to test them out, see where I could fit in. And I couldn't believe it.
She had you sussed?
She had me sussed. Now, there's a case. If I went in as a tramp, I'd have got the job. That, you know the way everybody dresses up for an interview?
You. Yeah.
This was a black mark against me for overdoing it.
So you,
and she was right. You, that's exactly what I had been thinking.
But you didn't pursue it.
No.
You kind of said you took it as a sign not to leave Dublin, did you?
Well, at that stage, I didn't know anyone in London. I wanted a safety valve. See, I was, remember, when you're on your own, you need to have contacts. You need to, now, the moment, you know.
You must have felt very much on your own, did you?
You see, you got to remember, when you're on your own, there's an insecurity. Mm-hmm. So you have to put up with a lot of stuff. Like, the job wasn't great, but if he left that, what would you do?
Mm-hmm.
Where would you go? Who would employ you? See, all this had come, and I was aware that, as I said to you, you had to take the good with the bad just to keep surviving. Now remember, there wasn't the help that they should have been given to people who left institutions. They didn't even want to know you. In fact, they don't know me even. I think to this day they don't know me. You learn to stand on your own feet. Now, not everybody was able to do that. A lot of them cracked up. And I tell you, it was horrendous what happened to people. Some of them were not able for this, but I'm not trying to play, but I was aware of it, because some of these, when they were sent out to jobs after they left the institutions, some of them ended up like slaves, and nobody was checking, and the conditions they were living under, some of them weren't even allowed into the house. They were left in a kind, some of them almost like a shed, and told not to be near the house, you know, even though they were working like slaves in the farms, and some of them even at the tailoring, some of them slept on the cutting bench. They told me, and I was aware of all this, and nobody was checking the conditions that some of these were sent to after they left the institutions, and a lot of damage was done to some of them. Some of them ended up committing suicide, some of them cracked up, and nobody bothered. That who are these? They're nothing, we don't want to know about it. Now, today, it wouldn't happen, those conditions, but they were appalling conditions. And unfortunately, some of them came back to school when I was there, and they told us what was going on. And you got afraid then, what might happen.
Mm-hmm.
So I was aware of all that. And that put the fear of God in you. So you put up with some things just to keep out of trouble.
Mm-hmm. I'd imagine back then in Dublin, and the way people dressed, and the way clothes were made, Dublin must have been full of tailoring places, was it?
Yes.
Tell me a little bit about the landscape of tailoring in Dublin,
yes,
in that time.
Well, back in the 60s, everybody got suits made, nearly everybody. And especially for Christmas, you were always busy before. You'd have your books, the books filled by September for Christmas, you know. And that was a great business. And then, of course, everybody got suits made for their weddings and all that. So, that was great business then the ready-made factories started coming more bigger and bigger, and suddenly imported styles started coming in from Italy and all that stuff. And that kind of wiped out the bespoke tailoring end of it. I know I moved then to dresswear. I ended up in Penguin Dresswear after it to tailoring and do the silks on the dress suits and all that. Then that went down. The dress hire service kind of went down as well. In fact, Penguin was the number one. Even Moss's brothers in England used to send people here to get the dress suits because they didn't want to hire them out if they were coming to a conference in Dublin, you know, to hire it there and give it back. So, now with the ready-mades coming in, very few could walk in and start their own, get the perfect fit. So, as a result of that, there was alterations. Now, in about 76, I moved out on my own, the Normand Quay, but I ended up making private stuff for tailoring. I used Cleary's to help me to get a start, made a few sample trousers, and of course, they got me to make a few larger private trousers and stuff. That kept me going. But then, they all stopped making suits. And some of the other tailors I used to work for stopped making suits. And then the move was, dude, you have to move more central and move into the alteration business. So I moved in 86 into Middle Abbey Street, into the alteration business. And the rest is history.
So you've been here since 86?
No, I'm in this one since 88. Down the road, I was five doors down. And I started in where that China place was in 86. And that helped pay for my house and all that stuff after that.
And that was the first part of my interview with Jude Hughes from earlier this week, folks. I am delighted to have been able to share that with you. It was such an honour to sit down and speak to Jude about his life and to have that one-on-one time with him to document some of his experiences. I'll pick up some of the rest of them on next week's show on This Irish American Life. And as you can hear, his life touches on many aspects of our recent history, and his life provokes many questions about how we conceive ourselves of Irishness and inclusivity and all those great things. So I hope you'll come back next week to listen to the concluding part of my interview with the great Jude Hughes. I have to say, it was a real treat to interview him. This broadcast of WNYE's Irish Radio Hour, This Irish American Life, comes to you in association with Flannelly Promotions Limited. I'm Dr. Miriam Nighan Gray, and I am your host every Saturday morning on WNYE 91.5 FM in the Tri-State area and broadcasting worldwide on www.irishradio.com. Our theme music is The Opening Set by The Gloaming, released by Brassland and Real World Records.